welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Caleb Carr's book, My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with My Beloved Monster by Caleb Carr. And in the last chapter, we learned that Caleb had taken Masha to the vet, who explained that Masha's wounds were made by a big black bear. The vet was impressed with Masha's bravery, and Caleb just nodded and smiled. Now we start with Chapter 16 from My Beloved Monster. It would nearly be Masha's way to self-regulate, to set her own boundaries, or to lack thereof, in the days following the encounter with the bear. She stayed true to form. Knowing that she needed to heal, she showed little interest in coming downstairs, much less going outside for a couple of days, and even when she started to do both, she exercised sensible control over her formal rush to get out into the world. Each afternoon, she'd softly descend the steps, make sure all was under control in the house, visit her box, trying more gently than usual to reach her cousins in Beijing, then take a few tentative steps out onto the porch. Lying down on the board, she'd let herself warm up, curl her big, splendid tail into the air, just enough to let anyone or anything within view know that she was unintimidated, then carefully walk to the backmost section of the railing and sit to study the stream bed. This was where her brush with eternity had almost certainly taken place. Since it was where bears were most often sighted when they came down the mountain from the cave dens, as she watched the scene her gaze would fill with intense scrutiny and even a little concern. Then she'd back away and go back inside and up to the library. I kept a careful eye on her during these brief descents. She didn't seem afraid, but rather like a cat who knew what she could and couldn't do, at least for the moment, and who wanted to get a general idea of what was happening and what had happened as she prepared for the future. Soon enough, her wounds closed up completely, and she started feeling spryer. As September arrived with its dull, lazy heat punctuated by the shrill sounds of catbirds and bluebirds, she began to walk the lawn again, remaining careful and observant, but always without doubt and defiant. As for me, it shouldn't be a thought that I was deaf to the incredulous questions of many people concerning my apparent decision to let her go on being an indoor-outdoor cat. After all, the general line ran, she had a very big house to be an indoor cat in. She certainly wouldn't be cramped, and she'd shown just how much trouble her wild side could get into. Didn't I think it was maybe time for her to learn to be genuinely domesticated as an indoor cat? And when I'd had enough of such comments, I answered one person with a short, "Sure thing, you teach her how." What I alone knew, of course, was I continued to know, was that deep inside her spirit, Masha still carried the injury of being locked up and abandoned, and that to confine her, no matter how big the house, would have been cruel. We'd have to see if she still moderated her behavior when she really felt like herself again. But I had the feeling that, like most wild or half-wild animals, she would so moderate. To whatever extent she felt was both wise and tolerable, if this was true, then confinement would be unnecessary, never mind impossible. But I'd have to be actively alert, or as actively as I could be, given my own reality, for any slip-ups. Masha's second October in our new home soon arrived, and she grew more relieved and happier as the leaves rained down and she felt the performance of the place, of her place in it. She grew more playful, too, although much more grown up than the harsh and brash young cat of years earlier. She still loved most of the same things she had then, still loved hiding from me as I went about whatever chores I could manage, and still delighted in bursting out to try to shock me sometimes, successfully, and she still loved, too, nestling in the finest gravel of the driveway and letting it have whatever was its crazy sensation or chemical effect on her species, then dashing off and halfway up a tree. Yet wariness remained apparent, the same loud noises, the gunshots in the distance, as turkey season began, faint dog barks or coyote yaps. The hooting of a barred arrow, the odd car passing in the hollow road, or increasingly rare pulling up to the house, got more of a reaction than before, and discouraged her from roaming too far. Sometimes they made her head under the porch, or even back into the house, with a look that plainly revealed she knew she wasn't quite ready to fully regain her kingdom. But it was also an annoyed look, as if to make plain that though she knew she wasn't ready, some day she would be, and all her subjects would pay dearly for any liberties taken. And if I was still outside when she went in, she'd occasionally poke her face back out, with an amusing glance of impatience at my failing to follow directly behind her. "Hey," I told her simply one day, "I wasn't the one who decided to beat up that damned bear." And it did really seem that, after having heard the vets and my discussion at the hospital, along with my repeated comments about the affair afterward, she'd generally come to understand the word bear, and that it irritated her immensely. That was quite a fall. Things were settling into dependable patterns, and Masha and I had no visitors, which was just as well. I wanted her to remain focused and accepting her permanence of her position and role, not only on the property surrounding us, but inside the house, without the distraction of interlopers. As for me, the United States had continued to prosecute two bitter wars on the other side of the world, and in those halcyon days when non-extremist opinions were still thought out by the press, I had a lot of op-ed writing to do, along with a great deal of correspondence with military officers and war journalists. Masha often chose to lie in her bed beside me during these sessions, a bit concerned at how many of them took place during the day and always preferring it when things got back to normal later at the night time. In this way we faced the coming of our second winter to get there, though we had at first to endure hunting season, which Masha detested, seeming to know what it meant that other people were dealing out death in her hollow, to the accompaniment of what I could call, when speaking to her, the boom booms. The sonnet ominous phrase, often applied to thunder, but it connoted especially close rifle fire, because of Masha's seemingly understanding of the danger of such reports, which were magnified considerably by the steep hillsides their trees now bear. Several people in my family hunted deer, being aficionados of venison, but my own enthusiasm for the practice had been trailing off for a couple of years, since one season when I'd been witness to or involved in too much buck fever. And one of the things I liked most about the new house was that the white-tailed deer in the hollow gathered to feed on its expansive lawn most nights, drawn in by the rich grass and the safety of the gentle but numerous and always burning porch lights, which warded off coyotes and often their more vicious relatives, the mongrel coy dogs. All this made the deer aware, in that way deer are almost always aware, of where they were and were not in danger, and my lawn, I soon told all hunters, was to remain strictly a safe haven for them. Also discouraging to any predator drives of my own was Masha's relationship to those deers. During the day, she would sometimes spy them in the fields not far off, along with the dairy and the beef cows, some of the latter mine, and they were pastured up across the hollow road. The sight made her strange kind of exciting. It wasn't that she thought that she could take them on. She knew how big they were, all, and she stayed clear. But she seemed to know that they were harmless, and watching them made her more than content. It made her happy, just as it made people happy. Yet, in that not-so-back of her mind, she also knew that those herding animals had not yet learned that she was the boss of all she surveyed, that she could get very agitated sitting in her northern windowsill if she saw them start to move in groups without her herding them, given any signal that such behavior was allowed. As for the deer, who she collected nocturnally, that sparked an even more interesting reaction in her. She could see them clearly, even and especially when I could not, and she wanted me to be alerted that they were there. So I'd sit on the floor by various window sills with her as she pointed them out with her eyes, occasionally glancing at me, as if to make sure that I, with my pitiable human eyesight, was getting it all. Only if I brought out the night vision binoculars to watch with her did she seem to accept that I was able to handle myself. And then we'd continue to stare out at the slow-moving shapes of adults and fawns, with Masha letting out a little snort and a shifting from one front paw to the other, every so often, quite reflexively. Winter followed hard on deer season, and that winter, though problematic in some physical ways, was otherwise a happy time. We had enough money to get through it without excessive worries, and the weather had not yet become as violent as it would in years to come. The truth is, I was the main problem. It's one thing to be told that you've got a chronic pain syndrome that won't ever disappear. It's another to learn to accept and live with that verdict as time actually winds on. My sense of disability, and there was no longer any point in avoiding the word, was matched by Masha's recovering strength, establishing our pattern in this regard. As one of us weakened, the other picked up the slack, until our respective conditions finally achieved greater equilibrium, and we could resume something like our original schedule of activities in the house. It was tricky as a process for me, one that involved tri-monthly trips to New York City to check on the neuropathy's progress, to see what physical therapy was available beyond more EMG, and other tests, none really were, due to the extraordinary pain inflicted by the ultimately unhelpful things like massage and manipulation. And to let my doctor and his very helpful staff gauge where we were with medication. We tried everything, from analgesics to Mastiff monthly vitamin B shots, fashioned had it then that B would be effective against neuropathic syndromes. It made no difference, and the pain meds, unfortunately, side effects. Opiates tend to induce headaches, especially in those prone to them, and of course, they slow down the gut, my own being already impeded by adhesions. So I kept poring over the copy of the PDR, the physician's desk reference, trying to find new medications that might help. I even stumbled on a comparatively mild epilepsy medication, far weaker than what we as boys had sometimes had to administer to our poor dog George when he went into fits. That marginally calmed the neuropathic stabbing spasms and vibrations. These were essentially electric shocks of varying intensities, and the medication eventually allowed me to get a few hours peaceful sleep at a time. I'd never been a sound sleeper, for obvious reasons, and now I would often be limited to such periods as the new medication allowed. Then, when it wore off, my always vivid dreams would turn troubling, and on occasion I would occasionally be woken by my own cries of pain and frustration. These developments consistently alarmed, but seemed in no way to confuse Masha. If I woke her, she knew what was up, and stuck her head through the divide of the blackout curtains surrounding her tree bed to check on my status, often jumping down from that perch and then leaping up onto the back of the love seat that I'd found was the best spot for my sleeping. With my legs out on a shorter ottoman or on the floor, I could pile pillows tight beside me and lean against them, staying upright while avoiding the exertion of holding myself there. Masha would take up a spot along the padded ridge atop the little sofa's back, which was just the height of the top of the room's wainscoting, so that she too could avoid the need to hold herself in position by leaning against the wall. There she would remain until I had gotten my bout under control, and only then would she return to her tree bed. Sometimes she remained longer, her face ever close by my head, until we were both ready to rise and face another snowy day. Occasionally I woke to the sound of her snoring, or simply breathing directly into my ear, sounds that could be funny, but were always a great comfort. The real problem for me was making sure I had enough exercise to at least partially counteract the atrophying and weakening effects of the neuropathy. The frozen outdoors was now more or less off-limits. I couldn't do so much as try winter sports anymore. Even simple walks held the danger of sudden falls on ice or snowbanks, and maybe a broken bone or joint. But here again, our fluctuating partnership played a role. Masha's exercise was completely indoors, except for her occasional dashes out onto the back from the frigid porch, and she often urged me to get up from my desk and keep to our usual schedule of chasing across the carpets up and down the stairs. If I refused for any reason, the mere sight of her sitting on the floor or in her bed by my desk, staring at me, genuinely hurt, or simply worried by my lack of participation, was enough to get me moving. Fortunately, the house's two open wooden staircases had been subcontracted to an impressive local carpenter who combined great utilitarianism with beautiful woodwork. Both of them had not only stout banister railings, but inner wood and iron handrails, which made it easy for me to now rely on my arms as much as my legs when getting up and down the staircase safely. I eventually became able, in this way, to almost keep up with Masha and keep the game fun for her. Then, as we headed toward the deeper winter, I noticed that Masha began to pay more attention to both of her hind legs during exercise hours, licking them suddenly if she took a very sharp turn or stumbled just a bit as she headed down the stairway too fast. She'd always shown signs of occasional soreness, but her attention hadn't been focused on both legs. And so I decided it was time for her to meet her new doctor. I introduced the idea of this new person into our conversation by referring to her as the Lady Vet, an homage of sorts to the Lady Eve, one of the signature classics of my favorite Hollywood writer-director Preston Sturges, as well as a way to distinguish the new doctor from the former. The day arrived. We headed to the Pittsfield Veterinary Hospital, a mere 20 to 25 minutes' drive from our house. Masha went willingly into the crate again, and also again she rediscovered the full range of her muse during the drive, trying to voice her apprehension and objections. It was always odd at such time to hear such a quiet, indeed mostly silent cat cry like any other. I did what I had done from the start, talking to her, telling her I understood. I know it's unfair, truly, but we have to go, and sticking my fingers through the grating that faced me so she could urgently scrape the sides of her mouth against them, trying to emphasize the seriousness of her protests. It didn't help that we were headed to a new hospital, since the last such unfamiliar place had brought an analysis of her wounds and an injection along with always uncomfortable, to say nothing of mortifying, rectal thermometers. But since Pittsfield's Vet was in a city of some size, for our area it also brought the interesting experience of encountering different sorts of animals in the waiting room. Masha picked right up on this. As we waited for her name to be called, she observed other cats and even a rabbit in a carrying case, along with the usual big dogs on leashes, which always enraged her. She'd claw at the grate of her own crate, then they took even a step or two her way, and when any of them wandered closer, she'd let loose her loudest of growls, wanting to get out and teach the intruder a sound lesson in manners, at which I'd have to work hard to get her focused back on me, since I knew that her wrathful behavior was no act. Once the polite but rather patronizing owner of one moderately large dog, a dog just the right size, I suspected, for Masha to claw, bite, and kick the tar out of, saw how agitated my Siberian maniac got at her canine's approach, and she said to me, "It's all right. He lives with cats." I scoffed sulkily, then turned away and murmured, "He doesn't live with this cat." I hadn't meant for the dog owner to hear that remark, but when she did, she pulled her canine away in a huff that could not disguise the deeper unease that my crack had inspired. The pair of them kept to the other side of the big room after that, while Masha kept her eyes nailed on the dog, who soon began to walk in circles and whimper. I put my finger into the crate to distract Masha. "Easy, girl. Leave the nice dog alone," I said, louder this time. I'll never know who the dog and its owner thought was crazier, Masha or me, but it was far from the last time that this kind of scene would play out, both in a similar hospital situation and on our own turf. Finally, we were led to an examination room by one of the assistants, and then in came the woman who was to have an enormous and always beneficial effect on Masha's life. The lady vet greeted Masha cheerfully as I got the latter out of her crate and kept a grip on her. And simply from the lady's vet tone and Masha's moderation of her usual anxiety in such situations, it grew clear that they might actually become friends. Another example, or so I presumed, of chemical identification going immediately to work with Masha's mind and soul. I did tell the lady vet that she might want to be careful of my Siberian's claws, and showed the several scratch marks on my own hands that were the result of a couple of recent roughhousing sessions. But interestingly, Masha now undercut by my assuming manner that she would very often employ during the first years with her new doctor, growing especially sweet-faced and even docile, so that the lady vet and her assistant began to doubt that there was an ever-present scratch mark could possibly have come from such a wonderfully behaved cat. I gave Masha a look at this. "Oh," I said, quietly but dubiously, "that's how you're going to play it? Fine, but some day they'll find out the truth." She only stared up at me, however, then rubbed her head into my hand and cried softly to reiterate her unhappiness and reinforce the con. Yeah, yeah, I said, chuckling and kissing her forehead. Go ahead, ham it up. We'll talk when we get home. At that last word she looked at me again, more earnestly and hopefully, but then it was time to get serious. I told the lady vet I was worried that maybe all was not well with Masha's wounds from the bear encounter, and after expressing an amused but controlled astonishment at the event to my companion directly, "A bear? Masha, what were you trying to do, buddy?" She began to have a close look at the two nearly healed spots and felt with her hands deep into Masha's belly to make sure all was okay there. Masha would always be buddy to the lady vet, and despite my cat's usual performance for her name and its close derivatives, it was the one alternative she really seemed to enjoy. Indeed, the discomfort of the thorough examination in the locale of the hospital notwithstanding, it appeared that my initial impression had been right, that Masha had taken to her new medical provider almost at once. It was a unique sort of meeting nobody and no thing else could have manhandled. Masha the way that lady did, not without fighting her back, even though anesthesia, as she had with her old doctor, and while Masha would sometimes, to be sure, elevate her objectives in years to come, proving to all hospital staff just why she had the fearsome reputation and why I so often bore scratch marks, the lady vet herself would become one of the very few people whose actual name Masha would recognize. Most important now, however, was that the lady vet's opinion of Masha's overall health, and especially the condition of her hind legs, for she had some important new insights into the situation. Having satisfied herself that Masha's wounds and internal organs were doing fine, she then moved to the original problem area. I told her about the arthritis diagnosis that the previous doctor had provided, which the lady vet, who knew and respected the other vet very much, slowly began to augment, in the way she had of relating news that might not be so good. Her voice slowed as she acknowledged what I told her, all the while moving her hands over Masha's hunches, launching into her stethoscope, and then feeling down her paws, and gently, yet firmly enough, to get an idea of what was going on. So, there's definitely the arthritis, though she's a healthy cat, that I'm wondering if that's the originating problem. Originating? What else could it be? Well, cats can, like people, develop arthritis post-traumatically, and her hips are a little asymmetrical, maybe from favoring one, but there's some bone scarring. It's the kind of thing we mostly see when cats that have an injury at some kind to the pelvis. A lot of times it's something like being hit by a car. I couldn't help but cut in, or a boot, I said, in a restrained yet pointed a voice, as I could manage. The lady vet tried to maintain a cool air, too, realizing she'd struck a nerve. That is the other common problem, unfortunately. I mean, anybody that'd lock her up to probably die wouldn't scruple at giving her a nice, firm kick if she played a little rough, which I'm telling you, she does, however she's acting right now. The lady vet laughed quietly. Yeah, I think I can imagine. But whatever the story, I'm feeling and hearing clarification that indicates some kind of fracture that didn't heal quite right. You say she does better with anti-inflammatories? If I can get them into her, which is next to impossible. I know, they're pretty bad, but we're getting some new ones in soon, liquids, that ought to be easier, and then as time goes on, and if the discomfort gets worse, we can try actual pain meds with her and see how she tolerates them. She rubbed Masha's head, getting a beseeching look in return. Maybe she will. You're big and tough enough, huh, Mash? This echo of my own nom de guerre for Masha's instantly endeared the lady vet to me, and Masha seemed to feel the same. She is, I said. I just wish she didn't have to prove it all the time. And I wish I could tell you that was going to change, the lady vet answered. It might someday, as she gets older. The trick's going to be getting her from here to there in one piece. Then we discussed Masha's vaccination schedule, the lady vet saying particularly stressed on rabies vaccines. If Masha was going to keep messing with wild animals that could potentially be carrying the disease. She also spoke about the need for a flea and tick treatment for such a wanderer during the spring and summer, something I'd been dreading, knowing what a profoundly irritating effect it would have on a cat who depended so much on the clarity of her senses, including smell, but also knowing that the lady vet was right. Then it was time for the thermometer and a couple of needles, vaccinations and a blood test, which I think Masha had hoped might not be coming, given that the lady's vet's sympathetic manner and whatever chemical emissions Masha had picked up from her. But she braved it all, and soon she was very ready to go, yet even then she exhibited a distinct note of friendliness toward the new doctor. On our way out of the examination room, the lady vet sealed the deal by announcing that she had read a couple of my books and had liked them. She said it casually as I paid up, giving me a bit of boost as I got Masha back outside into the cold January wind, and we hustled onto and into the truck. On the way home, I kept Masha music pretty low, so that its namesake and I could keep up with a lively discourse concerning the new ally, she who had just entered our lives. Masha lay on her side now, seemingly secure that we were heading home and that her nightmare was not only over, but had been mollified nightmare at that. All of which was noteworthy, given the extent of the exam and the shots. Masha would have been protesting loudly that she would never, ever so much as think about returning to Pittsfield Veterinary. And where did I get off taking her to such a house of horrors anyway? Yet this was not her mood as we sped back, and while it could just have been the various needles slowing her down a bit, I didn't think so. Masha had always been able to judge my own moods, physical states, and personal qualities correctly, and why should she have not applied these powers of chemical and emotional detection to the lady vet? Whatever the explanation, the bottom line was that they liked each other, and anyone who'd ever lived with any kind of animal knows the enormous role that a vet viewed as a friend plays in their and one's own life. And that's Chapter 16, My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, written by Caleb Carr. Next week we'll read Chapter 17, called Watch Cat. Well, that completes our readings for today. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Companions on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This has been Joyce Vesper, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.